historians point out, back then, almost all whites saw blacks as inferior. Just 4 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court declared keeping black people in their place the law of the land in the Plessy versus Ferguson case. In North Carolina, the ruling was soon followed by what might be called a real press riot. Milo Manley.
My father and a couple of his brothers set up this newspaper in Wilmington, North Carolina. It flourished and was going along very well.
Alexander Manley's Daily Record is believed to be the only black daily newspaper in the South at the time.
The whites that had been in power and had been slapped down put on a campaign among the rednecks and the uneducated to try to fight their way back up and get in control. And it precipitated a riot, and this is typical of what went on all around in the South. It was the planned deal.
Linda Gilmore teaches history at Yale University.
In the spring and summer of 1898, Furnifold Simmons, chairman of the Democratic Party, Charles Brantley Aycock, and Josephus Daniels met in a desperate attempt to find a way back to power after the Democratic Party had lost the governor's seat and the state legislature to a biracial coalition of Republicans and populists who became known as the Fusionists.
Senior political writer for the Raleigh News and Observer, Rob Christensen.
Many of the newspapers across North Carolina, including my newspaper, News and Observer, served as the propaganda arm for the white supremacy campaign of 1898. Josephus Daniels was the editor and publisher and owner of the News and Observer. He wrote about it in his memoirs. The News and Observer was the printed voice of the campaign, relied upon to carry the Democratic message and to be the militant voice of white supremacy. And it did not fail in what was expected, sometimes going to extremes in its partisanship, unquote.
In those days, newspapers were blatant about having a party focus. If you were the editor of what they would call the state Democratic newspaper, which is what Josephus Daniels' newspaper was, then you got all the state printing contracts.
Historian Glenda Gilmore.
And it didn't just happen in the South, it happened all over the country. Objectivity in journalism is not really an idea that comes in until the 1920s, 1930s.
Money has always been essential to the news business. One way to attract large audiences of news consumers is to make the news easy on the eye.
The News and Observer hired the first cartoonist ever hired by a North Carolina newspaper, and he ran a series of front page editorial cartoons nearly every day for a couple months, designed to whip up a white backlash.
Those images were important. Not long before, the Democratic Party boss of New York City said of another cartoonist, "Stop them damn pictures. I don't care what the papers write about me. My constituents can't read, but damn it, they can see the pictures."
There were front page editorial cartoons of white road workers toiling under the supervision of a black overseer.
According to the story of the Wilmington Rebellion written in 1936 by white journalist Harry Hayden,
Negroes were given preference in the matter of employment. For most of the town's artisans were Negroes, and numerous white families in the city faced bitter want because their providers could get little work as brick masons, carpenters, mechanics, and Wilmington was really becoming a mecca for Negroes and a city of lost opportunities for the working class whites.
Wilmington's white Democrat leaders and newspaper, The Messenger, called for, quote, white labor for white men.
George Roundtree wrote a memorandum of my personal recollection of 1898, here read by his grandson, George Roundtree III.
Each issue of the paper spoke of burglary, which had been committed, and lawlessness was rife, and especially were there references to disorderly conduct on the part of irresponsible Negroes. An accumulation of such things stirred my anger.
These public newspapers, eager for excitable news, would print some frivolous thing, comment on it, twisting what was written to please their political bosses, and after adding to it to suit their wits and prejudices, would send it broadcast to the public. I am Tom Keith, reading from Memories, Memoirs of My Grandfather, B.F. Keith, Alderman of the City of Wilmington in 1898.
Each day, just about, there was a news story with the latest rumor of a black outrage. If a crime was committed by a black person anywhere in the South, it made the front page of News Observer, and I suspect other papers as well.
The Democrats found their ploy in an idea they called, and I'm quoting them, home protection. White men must, in the words of Charles Aycock, restore to the white women of the state the security they felt under the previous 20 years of democracy.
There was a cartoon of a black administrator supervising a white girl at a state institution for the blind. There was a drawing of the white girls appearing before a Negro deputy clerk of court.
It became more and more dangerous for white girls and women to venture out of doors after dark. For black rapists prowled the streets of the city and countryside at night.
From a pamphlet by longtime Wilmington Star reporter Harry Hayden.
A defamatory and disgusting editorial in the paper published by Negroes brought the situation to a climax.
From the Wilmington race riot in 1898, Recollections and Memories by reporter Thomas W. Clawson.
It was in this tense atmosphere that Alexander Manley tried to counter the rape scare in August.
Manley's August 18, 1898 editorial read,
"The papers are filled often with reports of rapes of white women and the subsequent lynching of the alleged rapist. The editors pour forth volleys of aspersions against all Negroes because of the few who may be guilty. Our experience among poor white people in the country teaches us that the women of that race are not any more particular with colored men than are the white men with colored women. Meetings of this kind go on for some time until the women's infatuation or the man's boldness bring attention to them and the man's lynch for rape. Many of those who have thus been dealt with had white men for their fathers."
The editorial was a response to an old speech by Rebecca Latimer Felton, a leading advocate and orator for white women's issues.
"If it needs lynching to protect women's dearest possessions from the ravening human beasts, then I say lynch, 1,000 times a week if necessary."
Mrs. Felton's speech had just been reprinted in Wilmington's white Democratic newspapers. Black newspaper editor Alex Manley's view of intimate relations between the races was very different.
"Do you cry aloud for the virtue of your women while you seek to destroy the morality of ours? Tell your men that it is no worse for a black man to be intimate with a white woman than for a white man to be intimate with a colored woman."
This editorial was properly construed as a base slander of the white womanhood of the South.
2 months after it was published, that slander, as reporter Thomas Clawson put it, was headlined every day in pro-Democrat papers, including Clawson's own Wilmington Messenger.
Today, strong opinions, news analysis, and commentary are supposed to be limited to talk shows and editorial pages. At the turn of the 20th century, however, readers could only choose between the obvious and self-proclaimed biases of competing news sources. On the day after the 1898 election, and although Manley had gone, white leaders, including newsman Thomas Clawson, conducted a public meeting to announce,
"We, the undersigned citizens of the city of Wilmington and the county of New Hanover, do hereby demand that the paper known as the Record cease to be published and its editor be banished from this community."
From Wilmington's so-called White Declaration of Independence,
"We demand that he leave this city forever within 24 hours. If the demand is refused, or if no answer is given within the time mentioned, then the editor Manley will be expelled by force."
The conflict in Wilmington happened on the day after the Battle of the Ballot.
The Democrats swept the statewide elections, but Wilmington's white supremacists couldn't claim power yet because municipal elections were a year away.
"I took my Winchester rifle, assumed my position at the head of the procession, and marched to the Record office. We designed merely to destroy the press. I believe that the fire which occurred was purely accidental."
Ex-Confederate Colonel Alfred M. Waddell's story of the Wilmington, North Carolina race riots was printed in Collier's Weekly Magazine, November 26, 1898. Waddell later complained that the article was actually written by the magazine's reporter. George Roundtree.
I then started down the street and had not gone further than Sam Collier's house before I heard a firing across the
road. Shots rang out.
Firing crash and gunfire came with a terrible
sudden battle in
wartime. No one knows who fired those shots.
A half-grown Negro boy fired.
Thousands of women, children, and men rushed to the swamps.
From Reverend J. Allen Kirk's statement about the bloody riot in Wilmington.
And they lay upon the earth in the cold to freeze and starve.
The weather has been cold and dreary. Bone-chilling, drizzling rain falls sadly from a leaden sky. In the woods and swamps, innocent hundreds of terrified men, women, and children are wandering about, fearing the vengeance of the whites, fearful of death. Without money or food, insufficiently clothed, ragged for the most part, they reverted to savagery, fled from civilization, and sought a refuge in the wilderness. Fearing to light fires, listening for chance footsteps crushing fallen twigs, shuddering and peering gray-faced into the darkness, waiting, waiting they know not for what. Charles Francis Burke, special correspondent of Collier's Weekly magazine, the Committee of...
Most of the national news reports tended to be very much in favor of the white supremacists. By and large, they decided to accept the versions of the white establishment of the state.
News columnist Rob Christensen is senior political writer for the Raleigh News and Observer.
The day after the riot, Democrat leaders and their red shirt militias marched on City Hall. The fusionist administration quietly resigned. It was the only coup d'etat in U.S. history.
We felt as a nation that white people could take a page from the Book of Wilmington and find out how to manage people of color who had become too involved in the democratic process.
The white supremacists ran a second white supremacy campaign in 1900 that was every bit as racist as the campaign in 1898. The same front page editorial cartoons, the same racist charges. They even reprinted the Manly editorial. And the campaign was so complete that we did not have in North Carolina large numbers of blacks elected until the 1960s.
Columnist Rob Christensen.
Now, 102 years later, the publisher of the News Observer is a black man. The news business has advanced by light years. Newspapers have become much more professional. They are no longer partisan voices that they once were. There's been a dramatic change in the news business.
But has it changed enough? It's been said that freedom of the press belongs to those who own one. All news people, like all people, bring biases to their work, and it's not clear that integration in media ownership, management, and newsrooms has fixed the way race is covered now. You're listening to Race with History Between Civil War and Civil Rights, a special discussion starter program on media and myths.